This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Blood Red Snow, The Memoirs of a German Soldier on the Eastern Front, by Günther K. Koschorek, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Introduction. It's not easy to pull your experiences of the Second World War from your memory and then write a chronologically accurate report about them. Either you satisfy yourself with the incidental events which you have with difficulty sifted out, or you simply fill the gaps in your memory with lively fantasy. Many books have been published using the latter mixture, either glorifying the war by telling of what are indisputably acts of heroism, or interpreting it by means of malicious obituary, with the result that the reader is persuaded to regard soldiers as bloodthirsty murderers. I want neither of these. I intend neither to glorify nor to judge. I will describe the reality, how I, as an ordinary soldier, personally experienced and perceived the war on the front lines in Russia, from the autumn of 1942 until the bitter end, interrupted only occasionally because of injury. This book is an authentic report with descriptions of my own unforgettable experiences, impressions, and perceptions. The perceptions of an ordinary frontline soldier, referred to, in the slang of the day, as a lancer. Unlike many books, which rely on contemporary documentation, it does not discuss responsibility, or the lack of it, from the point of view of the command staffs in charge of the conduct of the war, nor even from the point of view of the leaders who had been specifically trained to be examples to their men, and who, as a general rule, fought alongside them in the front lines. The book is intended to be a tribute to the countless anonymous soldiers who spent most of their war in filthy foxholes in the Russian soil, relinquishing them only when they needed to engage the enemy directly, whether it be in summer in the boiling hot sun, during the rains in knee-deep mud, or in a winter blizzard with the ground frozen hard or covered in deep snow. The only hope for these men was the promise of a brief respite when they were permitted to rest with the rear area supply trains. But until that happened, their home was the frontline trench or the foxhole, there, on the main battle line, where day after day they worried about their survival and killed their enemies in order to avoid being killed. Where each man fought as a unit, but in the end had to rely upon himself. Where the earth around them often turned into a burning hell. Where they sensed the ice-cold touch of death when a glowing hot splinter or a fizzing bullet searched out their living bodies. Where the shredded corpses of their enemy were heaped in front of them, and where the piercing screams of the wounded would mix with the barely audible calls of the dying, touching them as they cowered deep within the ground and pursuing them in their nightmares. There cannot be many still living who, after half a century, can say that they survived the murderous war on the Russian front, or survived an inhuman imprisonment afterwards. But there most assuredly are still fewer who, thanks to some miracle, escaped the hellish inferno, and who, because of notes they made during those days, can now write about it. After my training, I graduated as a heavy machine gunner. As a result, my superiors employed me primarily in this speciality and as a heavy weapons gun team leader for most of my frontline service. I will not deny that, using this rapid-fire weapon, mounted on a gun carriage and equipped with an optical sight, I killed many of the enemy during the war on the Eastern Front. During this period, I made a number of notes with a view to writing up a factual report after hostilities had ended. Initially, I also kept a diary, although this was against regulations for the common soldier. I made my first comments in this diary as we, a freshly trained unit of young recruits, made our way to Stalingrad as replacement troops. Before we reached our destination, we marched for days, with heavy loads on our backs, through the shimmering heat of the endless Kalmuck steppe. During a massive Russian tank attack on the 13th of December 1942, at the edge of the Stalingrad pocket, our supply train and personal effects fell into enemy hands. Unfortunately, my diary was amongst the booty. I didn't worry too much, as I had only written down my impressions, which the Russians would not be able to make much sense of. My name was not in it, nor was the name of the unit I belonged to, although from the material they took they would in fact have been able to discover my unit. Later, while I was recovering from my first injuries, I again wrote down what I had experienced during this fateful period, the days and weeks in which we distraught Germans tried to escape the Stalingrad encirclement, finally fleeing headlong across the frozen Don under the shattering live fire from the approaching 100 Russian tanks. This incident ended a never-to-be-forgotten experience, as, almost deafened from the roar of the exploding shells and the incessant clatter of tracks, and blinded by the flashing close behind us, we made our way over mountains of emaciated corpses and wounded comrades, whose blood stained the snow red, to the safety of the other bank of the Don, which the day before had seemed so peaceful, covered in a mantle of fresh snow. After I lost my diary, I had made my notes on any scraps of paper which happened to be available at the time. I then folded these pages and slid them through a tiny slit in the lining of my uniform coat. During my short stay in the military hospital, I twice had an opportunity to pass these observations on to my mother for her safekeeping. I was convinced that no one other than I would be able to decipher my scribble, which was partly in shorthand. This hiding place in the lining of my uniform jacket apparently served its purpose, because when I returned home during my next leave, I again deposited my latest notes in the same place. The only difference was that now the notes were in the lining of my new winter coat, which I had last worn at the end of 1940, before I was called up to spend a year at the NSKK Motor Vehicle School in Itzehoe. This was preliminary military training to qualify for several different army driver's licenses. Sometime or other, I began to organize the notes chronologically, and to formulate an idea out of them. It became my fervent wish to write a book, but this ambition was destined to remain unfulfilled for various reasons. The years passed, though the flame was often rekindled. Then came the time when I mislaid my notes. I assumed that I had somehow lost them during a move, and it was only much later that I discovered that I had left them behind in our apartment in the 1950s, when I had gone through a traumatic divorce from my wife. After the divorce, my wife quickly did what she had longed to do. She married an American soldier, who took her and my daughter and a further child back to America. The decades passed, but the painful memories of the war years remained deep in my soul. Moreover, changes in society's attitudes, from what was once acceptable behavior to an unmistakable new wave, permitting lack of respect, aggressive attitudes, hatred, and violence, did nothing to help me forget those fateful times. Then, one day, I quite unexpectedly held my long-lost notes in my hands again. Reading merely a few lines from them brought images from the 1940s back to stark reality. It had all begun with a call from the United States. At first, I found no words as an unknown woman's voice with a decidedly American accent asked me for my name and thereupon addressed me as Daddy. It took a moment before I realized that the caller was my daughter from my first marriage, a daughter whom I had not seen since my divorce in the mid-1950s. It was a strange feeling to discover that I suddenly had a daughter who was married, and who, overnight as it were, had also made me a grandfather of two. She then visited my new wife and me in Germany, and she presented me with a wonderful gift, a folder containing all my wartime notes. These notes had been the only souvenir she had had of her father, and she had kept them all these years in the hope that one day she would be able to meet him again. It took almost 40 years. Her repeated attempts to find me had been frustrated by the many changes in addresses which I had gone through. Contact has remained intact since then, however, and we have enjoyed several holidays at her home in Las Vegas. Today, almost 60 years after World War II, we are fed images of hatred, acts of brutality, and footage of war by the various media directly into our homes. These events may cause a sudden chill to run up and down the spine, and perhaps bring tears to the eyes. But no one really understands the true hurt suffered by the victim. People see brutalization and atrocities. They are aghast, and they may discuss what they have seen, but images are quickly forgotten. Only the parties who were actually involved at the time experience the concentrated impact of the tragedy deep within their consciousness, and often it is only time that heals the wounds in their souls and lessens the pain. My wounds from World War II have healed as time has passed, but I can still feel the scars on my body and the injuries that remain implanted in my soul. And every time I am shown or read about some disturbing event or other in today's world, the awful images from those terrible experiences during the war well up from within to dance vividly before my eyes. It was exactly these memories which drove me, after several unsuccessful attempts, to write the present book, using my notes as the basis. Almost an entire lifespan lay behind me, and finally I had time to write, from the soul, about that from which I could never really free myself. It was not my intention to give the listener all the names, nor my unit's exact designation, as I wanted this book to concentrate on documenting my personal experiences and my mental impressions and observations, as well as my feelings and perceptions of the war. Should any of the members of my unit happen to read my writings, they will in any case be able to recognize it. I have written this book because I sensed an uncompromising duty to do so. It was time to set down that which, for all who have survived, will remain unforgotten. The survivors of the last war were tasked to become the admonishing emissaries of those who had perished on the battlefields, sentenced to eternal silence. This book is my contribution, and I feel that I have now fulfilled my obligation. Günter K. Koschorek. Chapter 1. En route. Today is the 18th of October, 1942. I am sitting on a bale of straw in a railway goods wagon, part of a troop transport. So far as the rattling and shaking allows, I am making the very first entries in my brand new notebook. About 3 hours ago, we boarded this train, we being about 300 freshly trained 18-year-old recruits, along with some Gefreiter, Obergefreiter, and Unteroffiziere. Finally, we have a little time to ourselves. The last 3 days have been extremely hectic. On our way to the front, we were first rushed through preliminary training at the Stablach Center in East Prussia. Yesterday, the commander of the training battalion at Insterburg gave us a rousing speech about our contribution to the operation in Russia. For us, this was a great moment, to have finally graduated and now be considered fully-fledged frontline soldiers. The commander's speech made us all feel extremely proud. He had spoken about the German army's far-flung commitments and its many successes, and about the mission that we were about to undertake on behalf of our Führer and our beloved fatherland. We were to accomplish this with all the strength and military prowess we could possibly muster. Our attitude was first-rate, not least because our daily suffering had also ended. The 6 months of training often involved a pretty harsh routine, and as a result many of us won't forget it in a hurry. But that's now all in the past. We look forward to a new era, a great future. Immediately after the commander's send-off, we exited the Insterburg camp through the main gates and headed straight for the railway station. Our marching songs never sounded as cheerful and confident as they did this sunny autumn morning. The Stablach Troop Training Center is well known to old soldiers as a place where harsh military training is meted out. It now serves as a transit area for replacement troops destined for the front lines. No one knows which front line we are being sent to, as this sort of information is classified. We were loaded into these wagons with 3 days' combat rations. Ever since then, the main question has been, what is our destination? The only person who might know is the Obergefreiter with the Iron Cross, second class, and the wound badge. He's in our carriage, but he's saying nothing and is calmly smoking his pipe. He and a couple of other fellows, who also have one or two chevrons on their sleeves, are supposed to have come from a convalescent company. They were assigned as senior occupants of each goods wagon by the Transportführer. We take it they are returning to their old units, to which we then might be assigned as replacements. Someone's heard that our unit is an old cavalry division, reformed as a tank division with 2 infantry regiments. The evidence is the yellow piping on our epaulettes. Yellow is the traditional colour of this former cavalry outfit, which has been in the Stalingrad area for a while. I don't attach any significance to this rumour. We'll wait and see. Of the 16 men in our wagon, only 6 besides me are from our training company. I only know the others by sight. There is Hans Weichert, who is always hungry. Next, there is a tall fellow called Varias, the flank man of the training company. Then there is Cooper, a muscular fellow with fair hair. The fourth man is a quiet, sensible chap called Grommel. Then there is Heinz Kurat, who plays the harmonica. The last man, Otto Wilke, uses every free moment to play cards. Even as I write, he is engrossed in a game with some of the others. I think back to the days I spent in the training camp, where in spite of the physically demanding work, I did enjoy some good times. I think about our strolls through Insterburg and the time spent at the Tanzcafé Tivoli, where you could sometimes get to meet a girl. I admit I was a bit shy on these occasions, and even blushed in front of girls, but I used to explain this away by using various slick excuses. I had no close friends at the time. I suppose I was a bit selective. 19th of October. It's Sunday, but you'd never know it. It was a bit fresh during the night, but now, since sunrise, it has got warmer in here. Outside, the countryside is drifting past us. It looks a poor sort of area. Everywhere you look, you see wooden houses and dilapidation. We pass through some little villages, and you can see farm buildings with thatched roofs and broken-down brick buildings in many places. There are some people at the next station, standing on the rails and on the platforms. In amongst them are some Wehrmacht uniforms. They look like guards. Some of us wave from the wagon, but no one waves back. Our train is moving very slowly, and the figures in front are staring at us. There are a lot of women among them. They have headscarves on, while the men all have peaked caps. They must be Poles. They look very downcast. They have shovels and picks for working on the railway line. At some of the main stops, we're given hot coffee and occasionally fresh sausage. We are slowly getting tired of canned meat. We also find time to wash and freshen up a bit. We don't know exactly where we are, but last night we're supposed to have crossed into Russia. In the early hours of the morning, we suddenly hear rifle shots coming from the front of the train. The train stops and an alert is sounded. Partisans are supposed to be around here somewhere. They get quite interested in goods trains. But everything remains calm. 23rd of October. Day after day, the wide expanses of Russia pass by. There are harvested fields as far as the eye can see, and in between some huge barns and farmsteads, the so-called kolkhozes. In the distance, I can see a group of figures marching in a long row. As they come closer, I can see that they are mostly women, loaded down with bundles. Some men are walking along, carrying nothing. Hans Weichert gets annoyed with the men for allowing the women to carry the heavy loads while they just walk along beside them. Our wagon chief, the Obergefreiter, explains, "In this part of Russia, that's normal. The payenkas, the girls, and the matkas, the mothers or women, are from childhood taught to do what the pan, or man, tells them to do. The men are real layabouts. They decide what's to be done. Whenever you see them, they are always walking alongside the women. Indoors, they are usually to be found lying on the clay ovens asleep. Nowadays, you mostly see only old men. All the youngsters have gone off to the war." In the last few days, our Obergefreiter has become more communicative, and in fact, he turns out to be quite a decent chap. It all started when some of the men called him Herr Obergefreiter. He would tear them off a strip, telling them that we were no longer in training. Besides, addressing someone with hair in front only began when he wore braid on his shoulders, starting with sergeants. "Are we supposed to address you with Z?" asks little Grommel.
"Don't be daft. Don't use Z to me. Just call me plain Kumpel. That's the way we do things around here."
"Or comrade," a slim, fair-haired fellow interjected. I don't know him, but he later told me he was a KOB, Kriegsoffizierbewerber, for which he would first have to prove his aptitude by serving on the front lines. The Obergefreiter raised his hands in protest.
"Heavens, not that. That word is better left for the armchair soldiers in the rear echelons, or those back home rather than us frontline blokes. I'm sorry, chum, but the comrades all get killed."
He then went on to tell us about his unit. It was a former cavalry division which in spring 1942 had been designated a tank division. He had been with it since it was reorganized and transferred to Russia, and he took part in the advance on Voronezh in June. The fighting had ended with many dead and wounded. In July and August he had fought with his unit past Chir and the Don, and on into Stalingrad. So it's Stalingrad after all, just as we had thought. However, we're not that near yet, we're only 7 days into the journey, and the only sensation is one of being shaken up and down. 24th and 25th of October. Our train is always being overtaken by other ones loaded with weapons and supplies for the front lines. Someone says we passed Kremenchug railway station last night. This means we are in the middle of the Ukraine, the granary of Russia. The Gefreiter, I now know his name, Fritz Martzog, says that we are being taken over Dniepropetrovsk and Rostov, and from there in a northeasterly direction to Stalingrad. He's right. A day later, during the early hours of the morning, we reach Rostov on the Don estuary by the Sea of Azov. The train stops in a siding near the railway station. There is water nearby, so we can freshen up. The weather is nice and warm, but it's still hazy, and we still can't see the sun. We're running around without shirts on, as we're told that we will be here for some time. I am just about to visit some friends in the next wagon, when all hell breaks loose. We hear the sound of engines, and dropping suddenly out of the sky, three Russian fighter aircraft come for us with machine guns rattling. Even before the command, "Aircraft, take cover," rings out, most of us are already underneath the wagons. I can see sparks flying off the rails and hear the zing of the ricochets. Then everything is over, but immediately someone yells, "They're coming back!" Sure enough, I can see them turning and coming straight back at us. Suddenly all hell is let loose for a second time. The sirens wail and a storm of firing breaks out, so loud that my eardrums almost shatter. There must be several anti-aircraft batteries in the railway complex, now laying down crossfire. The three aircraft immediately peel off and disappear, unscathed. We all look at each other a bit stunned. Everything happens so fast, and it is all so different from training days when the instructor yelled, "Aircraft, cover!" This was the real thing, which explains why we'd never taken cover so fast as we did now. Someone says that somebody has been hit. It isn't serious, a graze on the leg which the medic can sort out. "All wagon seniors report to the Transportführer for orders." The message is passed down the train. Obergefreiter Martzog returns shortly afterwards with news. He says that two open flatbeds will be coupled to our train, each with a twin anti-aircraft gun, to protect the train against enemy air attack. So, they reckon there will be further air attacks. In addition, from now on we have to place two men per wagon on guard duty every night, due to the increased chance of an attack by partisans. We may also have to make detours, because we have to reckon on rails being blown. The straw underneath us is flattened, and we don't have any fresh, and the blanket which has been thrown over it doesn't help very much. It feels as if we're lying directly on the carriage floor. The tall fellow, Varias, and several others complain that their hips are hurting. The Obergefreiter smirks and tells us that it's good training. It's worse in the dirty foxholes on the front line. We get him to tell us about the successful campaigns his unit fought in the summer, and this makes us even more impatient to get to our destination as soon as possible, so as not to miss out on anything. Dieter Malzahn, the tall, fair-haired KOB, Kriegsoffizierbewerber, expresses in words what we're all thinking. Martzog replies somewhat laconically, "Take your time, lad. When you're up at the front, your arse will go from 1 to 100 soon enough." This is old news. We've heard this sort of remark before, usually from men from one of the convalescent units. What they meant was that we, the young squirts, will shit in our pants the first time we get fired upon. Nonsense. When so many others have made it, why shouldn't we? Besides, age has nothing to do with it. Nearly every time the train stops, we hear favourable Wehrmacht radio reports booming out over the loudspeakers from the Transportführer's wagon. So it is today, the 25th of October, a report telling us all about German victories. It makes us feel good, and we start singing battle songs. The countryside has changed since yesterday. We were passing villages every now and then, but today, on both sides of the line, there is nothing but brown-coloured steppe, with the occasional small hillock. Once in a while you can see large kolkhozes. The driver brings the train to a halt in the middle of this landscape. We climb down from our carriage. The driver has noticed that a section of the railway line had been blown up. We now have to back up along the track for almost 12 hours so as to get onto another line. Progress is now a series of jerks. The engine wheezes like an old walrus as soon as there is the slightest incline. We carry on like this for quite a while, until suddenly everyone sits up. There, over a hill in front of us, is a huge dark shadow, like a bird of prey, coming right at us. First, we hear a low droning noise, then a crescendo roar like a swarm of bees.
Take cover! Air attack!
We lie flat on the ground, and overhead comes the rattle of aircraft cannon. I can see dirt being thrown up where the shells hit the ground. Then our AK-AK begins to spit back. I look up and see small bombs falling from the plane. They explode in front of the train on the engine. Then again the mad buzzing noise, and he is gone. Our anti-aircraft fire didn't manage to get the plane, but there's not much damage. A couple of splinters hitting various parts of the engine and making some holes in the sides of the wagons. Martsog tells us about it.
That was the Iron Gustav, a Soviet combat fighter, which Ivan also uses at the front lines. It's a nimble, low-altitude, close support plane, which appears from nowhere and sprays everything with its automatic cannon. It often also drops small bombs, and sometimes larger ones. Standard ammo is quite useless against it, as it has an armor-plated belly.
After this incident, we carry on, pushing the train uphill and riding it downhill. How long can this go on? But eventually we come to the end. Nothing more can be done. We can't move the train any further, even by pushing it. What now? We are stranded somewhere in the Kalmuk steppe, with 320 men and a good 40 pounds of personal gear for each one. How far is it to Stalingrad? The Transportführer tells us,
about another 140 or 150 kilometers.
Apparently, because of all the detours and delays, we're well behind schedule. We are informed that we will therefore complete the journey on foot. We have to reach our destination in 4 days. We are told that we will spend the night in the wagons and set off in the morning at 0600. 26th of October. Rivelli is at 0500, and it is still dark. We get hot coffee and half a loaf of army bread per man and a piece of hard-cured sausage. We noticed yesterday that the rations had been decreased. A few men with injured feet will remain behind with the train and anti-aircraft crews. We load up our kit and on the order, route, march, take off with compass and map. Now for real hardship, which will inevitably dent our enthusiasm. We start off singing, but slowly and surely this dies away. The sun gets up and it becomes warmer. At lunchtime, a longer rest is ordered. During the afternoon, the sun really beats down. We still have some reserves, and although we're very tired, we carry on well past nightfall. We just collapse to the ground in a hollow in the steppe, catch our breath, and then unroll our ground sheets and blankets from our kit bags. That night, we sleep like the dead. 27th of October. This morning, my legs are as stiff as an old pack horse's, and the rest of the men are feeling no better. I eat a slice of bread and take a sip of my cold coffee. Goodness knows when I'll get something to drink again.
Up and at it!
The fellows up front start out at quite a rate of knots. The train company does not have that much to carry, but the rest of us are loaded down like pack animals. We carry the full kit with blanket and ground sheet, steel helmet and heavy winter coat thrown over it. We have a full ammunition pouch on the belt, on our backs the kit bag with the field canteen, and on the other side the folded entrenching tool. A gas mask is slung around our necks, resting on the chest, and the heavy rifle swings back and forth from its strap round the neck. Lastly, a ditty bag is carried in one hand, filled with clean socks, underwear, and similar items. The whole lot weighs about 40 pounds. Time passes. Men regularly fall to the ground exhausted. After a while, having caught their breath, they stand up again and struggle on. Many stragglers look pale and sickly. They are completely exhausted. Suddenly, a message comes from the head of the column. Relief!
Village, up ahead!
That means water and something to eat. We summon our last resources and drag ourselves on. Soon we can see the houses. There are only a few, but there are also several barns belonging to a kolkhoz, just like we saw on the wide Russian steppes. There is a well in front of the first hut, with a windlass and a dented bucket. A Feldwebel stands a few feet from the well and waits until the first men get there. Those in front are dashing up to it, wanting to let the bucket down.
"Hold it!" yells the Feldwebel.
The man at the windlass lets go of the bucket, which now crashes down into the well. The Feldwebel suggests that the water may perhaps be poisoned. He goes up to one of the houses, one that has nice wooden carvings on the windows, and goes in the door. Not a soul can be seen. The Feldwebel reappears with a scruffy-looking fellow from the house. He is an old man with a bushy beard and is dressed in the typical quilted jacket. The Feldwebel is dragging him over to the well, holding onto his sleeve with two fingers. The bucket is now full of water up from the well and reflecting the gleaming sunlight. With a gesture of his hand towards the water, the Feldwebel now demands,
"Drink, Rusky!"
The old fellow looks at him with a crafty expression, smiles and refuses several times while repeatedly saying something like,
"Pan Karosh! Pan Karosh!"
The Feldwebel now becomes impatient. He grabs the old fellow by the neck and shoves his face in the bucket. The old boy chokes and swallows. He looks a bit surprised, but not too concerned. In other words, the water's safe.
"Okay, you can drink the water," says the Feldwebel.
Bucketful after bucketful is now brought up, and the old fellow starts to grin. He has finally realized what this was all about. We wallow in the water, drinking all we can, and then use some to freshen up. The kolkhoz is a disappointment. We can't find any food anywhere. In one shed are a pile of mangelwurzels and a few ears of corn. Cooper bites a chunk of mangelwurzel, but spits it right out again. Meanwhile, a number of women have come out of the houses and are gawking at us. Weichert says the old Russian chap has mentioned something about a garrison headquarters and confiscation. That probably means that some German unit or other has already taken off with anything that's edible. 28th of October. We march onwards with empty stomachs. Hour after hour passes. We sweat, we swear, many of us shout out just to lighten our spirits, but we still have to drag ourselves forward, kilometer after kilometer. Then suddenly the peace of the countryside is broken by a dull, throbbing sound.
"Take cover! Air attack!"
someone yells. We try to run for cover just as we have been trained to do, but after a couple of paces we go down on the spot. I scan the sky, and on the horizon can pick out some aircraft coming towards us, their tails glinting in the sun. We can tell they're heavily loaded with bombs, ready for the kill. They are coming closer. Then we can make out the cross insignia under their wings and realize that they're German bombers up on a mission, so we stand up and wave to them. They disappear in a northeasterly direction with their deadly cargo. That must be Stalingrad over there. We trudge on.
"How far is it now?"
asks little Grommel, who has made himself comfortable between me and Matzog. Matzog shrugs his shoulders.
"No idea, but I heard we're supposed to get there tomorrow."
As if in answer, we hear a heavy muffled noise in the distance, followed by what sounds like rolling thunder. As it starts to get dark, we can see a red glare in the sky in the far distance.
"That's Stalingrad," someone says. "What are those lights?"
Varias makes a gesture with his hand. We look towards where he is pointing and see a row of lights in the sky, just like lanterns. Then we hear more muffled explosions, and straight after that we can see long bright strings of pearls, which start from the ground, continue up into the sky, and then disappear. Someone remarks,
"That's the runway radar."
The old veteran explains that this is a light biplane, which generally operates at night over the runway, letting off flares suspended on little parachutes to illuminate targets. Then the plane drops a number of small bombs or fragmentation bombs. The pilot can turn off his engine and sail noiselessly towards his target like a glider. When the enemy discovers him, it's usually too late. The frontline troops have called him the Nähmaschine because that's what the engine sounds like. The old soldier goes on.
By the way, those strings of pearls in the sky are tracer rounds from the 20mm twin barrel and quad anti-aircraft guns, which are trying to shoot him down.
It's a great show. More flares appear, and more strings of pearls follow in the night sky. It's odd, but we can't hear anything. It's like a silent movie.
29th of October. A new morning is breaking, and our morale is at zero level. For an hour now, a fine drizzle has been coming down, and some of our men are quite outspoken about their dislike for it. The rain gets heavier, and now it's windy as well. For the first time, we are experiencing really lousy weather, something we hadn't expected. The gusts become stronger and stronger, and the open countryside offers no protection. The raindrops lash your face like fine needles, drumming against the steel helmets that we've put on to protect us. The wind tears at the ground sheets which we've wrapped around us, and they don't make much difference. They slap against our wet trousers, and the cold wind practically knocks us off our feet. We trudge on. Several hours go by, then we finally spot a village. It has stopped raining. We find some empty barns and sink gratefully to the ground. It's quite busy in the village, with privates and other ranks all over the place. They snap to attention and salute each other. Have we reached the front line or not? There is plenty of evidence here that this area has been taken over by a headquarters and regimental staff. In other words, the Organisatorischen Schreibstubengefechtstände, as Martzog puts it. Our Transportführer is supposed to be organizing some rations for us. It works, and we all receive a large helping of barley soup with meat chunks. They live quite well here. After the soup, we feel a lot better. What next? We wait and we wait. Then there is an announcement. There are still 8 or so kilometers to go. New strength is awakened in us. Although our bones ache and the blisters on our feet hurt, we manage to march the rest of the way in about an hour and a half. Quite an achievement, considering the weight of our kit. Rumour has it that we will be picked up by vehicles from this point. However, they're not yet here, so again we have to wait. They arrive at dusk. We drive into the darkness, then over a long bridge with lots of other vehicles. The River Don, someone behind me remarks. Then we continue on the MSR, more commonly referred to as the runway. We drive without lights because of the runway radar. We can see his flares close up now, and can quite clearly hear the bangs as his bombs go off. After a few hours, we stop somewhere amongst some cottages. We are quartered in them for the night. In the distance we hear the rolling thunder, and the sky is glowing red. That's Stalingrad, all right. How is our enthusiasm compared to how we felt last week? It's definitely suffered because of the forced march we've just had to make, and we reckon that enthusiasm and euphoria are in short supply here. The reality is rather different. It's not something that gives you a good feeling at all. Well, we've reached the first stage towards our destination, and we'll now have to see how things work out. For the moment, though, I'm off to sleep. To forget everything.
Chapter 2. Fighting in Stalingrad. October 30th, 1942. Reveille is at 0600, and it's still dark outside. We get some hot coffee and food. No one knows for certain what's happening, although there are lots of rumours. One says that we still haven't reached our destination. Another says that this is only one regiment from the division. We'll go from here to our unit in Stalingrad. The unit's strength is reported to have been dramatically cut, and we are the replacements. We're told that the entire regiment doesn't even amount to 2 companies at the moment. Rumours are often the only source of information for the common soldier. Even if they don't exactly fit the facts, there is normally a certain amount of truth in them. I miss Obergefreiter Martzog and the others from the convalescent company at Insterburg. It seems they have already been picked up. Now, for us, the usual routine starts up. Fall in, 2 ranks. We line up so that we're always in the second row, so that we can stick together, all except for Malzahn. The entire group is 90 men strong. To the 1st Battalion, Regiment 21, orders a young Oberleutnant. Round about noon, we are picked up by some trucks and four Mercedes personnel carriers. The vehicles are all wearing the division's tactical emblem, a leaping rider in a circle. I'm given a seat next to the driver of an 8-man personnel carrier. We set off along an MSR, a wide road packed with traffic. The road is undulating, the surface smooth and shiny like bacon rind, stretching away across the steppe, almost in a straight line. Now and then, roads branch off, the junctions plastered with unit designation symbols and the names of villages. Rumours are flying. It's no longer certain that we're going to Stalingrad. I ask the driver, who's an Obergefreiter. He says that we are not going to Stalingrad, but rather to a so-called winter position. This is where the baggage trains are situated, because they can no longer be brought into Stalingrad, from which the troops fighting in the northern suburbs of the city are supplied with food and ammunition. 31st of October. The winter position is close to a kolkhoz in the open steppe. Along one side there is a rachel, a deep, often long, rectangular trench where the steppe suddenly dips down. These rachels are natural geological phenomena and are often 10 to 20 feet deep in the otherwise flat landscape. A rachel can be small or large enough to give protection to an entire battalion, complete with vehicles and men. A Hauptwachtmeister, in soldier slang also referred to as Spieß, or Mother of the Company, meets us. He informs us that we now belong to a division rich in tradition, which even in the Polish and French campaigns was still a cavalry unit. He explains that the unit is therefore particularly proud of its old cavalry designations. A Feldwebel is called a Wachtmeister, and a company is called a Schwadron, whilst a battalion is called an Abteilung, and a Hauptmann is a Rittmeister. "Yes, Herr Hauptwachtmeister," we yell at his question, whether we have understood him or not. After one more division, we are 30 men in the first Schwadron, while the others are sectioned off to the other Schwadronen, located quite close to us, actually. We are then informed that our Schwadron was fighting with a total strength of only 26 men. Our regiment was also under strength. It was fighting in the ruins of Stalingrad, mostly in small combat units, which, because of the scarcity of officers, were frequently led by Unteroffiziere. The engagements were said to be murderous. Brick walls were no longer standing, and the piles of dead and wounded got higher every day. This news certainly didn't breed enthusiasm. What had happened to all the successes and the reports of the proud German army's advances, the ones we'd heard only a few days ago? Were they exaggerations, or was this merely a temporary setback to the usual run of successes? 1st to the 6th of November. Considering the situation, we are all surprised to discover that we are not off to the front immediately. Instead, we have to put up with the normal army Mickey Mouse routine. Salute the officers, stand to attention, take up formation, listen to guff from our leaders, and so on. Even when their training is completed, recruits are only novices and have to prove that they are real soldiers. All well and good, but they should give us the opportunity to prove it. 9th of November. The intermittent explosions and general racket from the Stalingrad front are barely audible here. At night, the sky is always red, and the paralights of the Rollbahn UVD can often be seen out searching for likely targets. This evening, stuff from the stores is being handed out. Each man gets a bottle of juniper brandy, some cigarettes or tobacco, a little chocolate, and some writing materials. When I was 16, I barely survived a bout of alcohol poisoning while on holiday, helping a friend bottle cognac for his parents' restaurant. I now throw up if I so much as smell alcohol, so being a heavy smoker, I'm swapping my brandy with some of the non-smokers for extra tobacco or cigarettes. The alcohol brings a bit of atmosphere into our bunker, and after a while, song is in the air again. Grommel and I stay sober because we have to take over the next watch. It's cold and windy, and I'm glad I've got my heavy-lined winter coat. During our march, I cursed it on more than one occasion because of its great weight. I wake Grommel for his shift, and all the rest are sleeping. There is a stench in the bunker that knocks you over, so I let in some fresh air. 11th of November. The weather is colder, but at least it stays dry. Overnight, everything has been covered in white frost, like fine filigree. There is movement in the air every day. Our bombers are flying towards Stalingrad. You can pick out the Russian anti-aircraft defense zone from the puffs of smoke in the sky. I am on watch with a friend from our bunker. The supply truck has just returned from Stalingrad, as it does every night. They unload 2 dead and 3 wounded. An Oberwachtmeister is said to be seriously wounded. They're loading the wounded into an ambulance, which will take them to the main medical station. Up to this point, we hadn't seen any dead men. The bodies are always buried in a special spot. I saw all the wooden crosses days ago as we drove by them while on manoeuvres. 3 Lancer have come back with the supply truck and are to be reassigned for health reasons. They are told to go to different bunkers, and one of them comes to ours. I return to the bunker after my guard duty and discover that my place on the mattress has been taken. The Lancer from Stalingrad has taken it. I can hardly make out his face. It is covered with beard stubble. His peaked cap almost covers his eyes, and the ear flaps are pulled way down over his ears. He is in a deep sleep, though he doesn't snore. Every now and then he gives a twitch, as if he's having a bad dream. I lie down in Kurat's place. He is the guard who relieved me. 12th of November. Today, at noon, our sergeant major has taken me off manoeuvres and given me a special job. I've got to dig a new latrine because the old one is already full up. The 2 Russian prisoners taken out of Stalingrad a couple of days ago are supposed to help me with this task. This is the first time I have seen Russian soldiers up close, and I look at them with curiosity. In their dirty brown coats and greasy headgear with long ear flaps, they do not look particularly trustworthy. They do not exactly ooze danger, but rather just give the impression of being more foreign. One seems to be of Mongolian descent. Their faces are unshaven and grey, with restless eyes. I can sense insecurity and apprehension in their faces. I would probably feel the same if I were in their shoes. Both Russians turn out to be quite lazy types. I reckon they are between 25 and 30 years old. I have to chivy them quite often in order to get work out of them. We have just finished digging, and I am just admiring our work, when a Russian standing next to me throws his shovel down and lunges past me directly into the trench. The other leaps after him, and I crouch down, thinking, before jumping into the trench as well, landing directly on top of the first Russian. All 3 of us are now flat on our stomachs in the trench, and can hear the rattle of aircraft cannon as the shells hit the ground directly above us. Then a shadow, accompanied by a droning noise, which I know all too well, flies sideways over and past us. The Iron Gustav must have crept up on us while coming in low over the Kolkhoz. The new latrine is some way from the rest of the unit. I peer over the edge of the trench towards the bunker and the vehicle dugouts. The Iron Gustav is turning back at low altitude, and he again opens fire with his 2 wing-mounted cannon. He also drops several medium-sized bombs. Then suddenly there are 2 more combat aircraft in the sky. They also spew metal from their wing-mounted cannon and drop bombs. The other part of our unit must be over there, or are they firing on the men on manoeuvres? Machine guns from all over the place now fire back at the aircraft, and I can also hear the louder bangs from a 20mm anti-aircraft cannon. Sparks are flying from the bellies of the aircraft, just as if someone is doing some welding. Normal bullets bounce off the armour, but suddenly there's a smoke trail, a hit. 1 Iron Gustav peels off, smacks into the step, and bursts into flame. The rest flee. I jump up and head for the bunkers and the vehicles. Except for the men in the orderly room, only a few sick and a couple of drivers have stayed in the bunker. I can see 1 or 2 bomb craters close by the vehicles, some of which have holes through their side panelling. Petrol is escaping from one of the trucks. The rest of the unit arrives back from manoeuvres late in the afternoon. They've heard nothing about an air attack. They were much too far away. Varyas says that they were near Karpovka, along the Kalach-Stalingrad railway line. The damage to the bunker is quickly repaired. 13th of November. The weather has hardly changed. It's cold and dry. It's supposed to be minus 15 degrees centigrade or 2 degrees Fahrenheit in Stalingrad. The Russians are launching attacks in our unit's sector every day, preceded each time by a big artillery barrage. The attacks have so far been repulsed, but with heavy losses. There are now only 18 men left on the front line from Arschwadron. The entire regiment has been reorganized into a single combat unit and is moved around to where it is needed most. Hot meals and fresh ammunition arrive more or less on a daily basis. Besides the Kitchenwallers and Unteroffizier Winter, the medical orderly goes along, plus two drivers with their vehicles. Two volunteers are needed to lug the mess buckets around. Cooper and I volunteered yesterday. The roster goes around from bunker to bunker, and now it's the turn of our one. It's almost dark when we move off. We've got one Steyr 70 MTW personnel carrier with a soft top and a 1.5-ton Opel Blitz 4x4 with a tarpaulin cover. We drive off into the dusk with our lights dimmed. The Kitchenwaller knows the way, but he says that there can be no talk about a Hauptkampflinie in Stalingrad, as amidst all the ruins the front shifts hour by hour. Not long ago, our line lay north of the tractor factory, but as of yesterday it is apparently further to the south, in a sector known as the Tennis Racket. The Russians are supposed to have a chemical factory there which they are defending, so they have set up a bridgehead. "We need to ask for directions," Unteroffizier Winter says to us. "Well then, let's go. We can only hope that we find them soon." We are now driving purely by the light of the moon on an MSR. Traffic comes towards us and also overtakes. To the right is the railway line running from Kalach to Stalingrad. Just beyond Voroponovo station, we turn off to the left, and after a few kilometers we're already well inside the ruins of the city. We drive through shallow craters and over heaps of rubble, avoiding debris and overturned telegraph poles. Thick, acrid smoke from smouldering fires chokes our lungs. To the left and right are burnt-out wrecks of various bits of military equipment. Our driver zigzags slowly towards what looks like a small forest or park. We are now standing on top of a small hill and can see something of the city. More black smoke and smouldering fires. A terrible sight, and we can feel Stalingrad's hot breath. This must be how Rome looked after Nero put it to the torch. The only difference is that here the inferno is made worse by the screaming shells and lethal explosions, increasing the madness and giving the onlooker the impression that he's witnessing the end of the world. The further we penetrate into the city, the closer the shells fall around us. "The usual evening blessing from Ivan," remarks the medic. It was supposed to sound light-hearted, but it falls flat. He is sitting cowering on ammunition boxes, as I am. My heart is hammering in my throat. Fright has gripped me. Now there is a new noise in the air, like the rush of 1,000 wings. It is increasing in intensity and seems to be coming directly at us. "Get out! It's the Stalinorgel!" yells the medic. We jump out of the wagon and dive for safety underneath a large burnt-out tractor. The rushing noise passes us, and then the explosions rain down around us, just like fireworks. A splinter the size of a man's hand spins by my head and hits the ground beside Cooper.
"That was a bit of luck," says the medic.
Behind us we hear yells and cries for the medic.
"Someone from the anti-aircraft position must have been hit. That's the one we drove by," says Unteroffizier Winter, who has just jumped into a hole. "Come on, let's go. We've got to get on."
We climb back onto the vehicles. The medic says that the Stalinorgel is a primitive rocket launcher mounted on the back of an open truck. The rockets are fired electrically. They can't hit a precise target, but by using this weapon, Ivan can saturate a large area of ground, and God help those who find themselves inside it without any shelter. We are now driving very carefully. Many places have had to be thoroughly cleared so that vehicles can get through the wreckage. We meet other vehicles, who seem to have the same idea as we do. Many of them are loading up with wounded and dead. They can only do this at night time, when in theory the Russians can't see what's going on. But the enemy does know what's going on, and he is pulverizing the area with his artillery and other big guns. There are always some Nemaschinen in the air. We can often see these biplanes quite clearly, silhouetted against the fiery glow in the sky. Tracer rounds climb high into the sky, and in front of us we can hear the rattle of machine gun fire. I can tell it's Russian fire by the sound. Hand grenades are going off, and we can hear yelling, so we come to a halt amidst the ruins. Winter disappears, returning some minutes later.
"Our people are supposed to be in the same area they were in yesterday," he says. "We'll move in as close to them as we can, and then we'll have to carry the stuff the rest of the way."
The vehicles move off again, gingerly, a yard at a time. I can see two burnt-out Russian T-34 tanks. We pass them and come up to a large building with big open spaces, like a factory. In the background, standing out against the glow of the fire and rising out of the ruins, is a tall chimney, looking for all the world like a threatening finger pointing up to the sky. We pull up in the shadow of the factory. We start to unload, but Russian artillery shells are falling precisely where we want to go. Some of them land pretty close to us as well. A fire flares behind us. A vehicle has been hit. There is another big blaze nearby, probably a petrol dump or something like that. We wait, all ready to go. There are craters in front of us, lumps of stone and piles of debris, and between the screams of artillery shells and the thunderous roar as they explode, I get goose pimples. We move in zigzags, clambering over stones and beams, stumble, lie flat on the ground, get up again, and continue on.
"Stay close together," croaks Winter.
In the glare of a fire, I can see men running, then some hand grenades go off. Several figures run past us, bent double. Winter gets up and speaks to them. I can recognize an officer's uniform.
"We've got to move further over to the right," he says afterwards. "A couple of hours ago they threw Ivan out of this area. Now there's hell to pay because he wants to take it back."
We creep carefully forward, then we come to an open space littered with clods of earth and concrete blocks with iron rods sticking out. This was perhaps once a bunker, destroyed by our bombs. A long wall rises at the other end. Three pillars are still standing.
"They're supposed to be there somewhere," says Winter, pointing to the wall.
We can't go any further. Ivan is firing like mad at the churned-up ground which we have to cross. Has he spotted us yet? We crouch down behind the concrete blocks, but the shells are landing so close to us that I can sense the hot metal on my face and can feel the muscles on my back cramping up. In front of us, tracer bullets shoot up into the sky. Rifles and machine guns crackle. Is Ivan on the attack? The shooting gradually dies away.
"Go, now, to the wall!"
It's Winter barking out his orders. We run through the confusion of rubble, wire and lumps of iron. We can't see anybody. We slither along the wall and come to a basement entrance. Suddenly there's a shout from somewhere, as if from the grave.
"Hey, mate, get out of here! What do you want to do? Bring Ivan down on our heads?"
A steel helmet sticks up from the ruins.
"We're looking for our unit,"
I hear Winter whisper.
"Which one?"
Winter tells him.
"No idea. We don't belong to that crowd. But if you're looking for the ones who chased Ivan out of here this morning, you'll find them about 50 meters further to the right in that large factory building. But get out of here, and thank your lucky stars it's quiet at the moment."
The head with the steel helmet disappears again. He calls this quiet. We hardly dare lift our heads out of the dirt. During a short lull, we stumble on, pieces of broken glass crackling under our feet, shadows springing out of the ruins. Immediately, tracer bullets zip towards us, and bursts of machine gun fire hit the wreckage all around like a hailstorm. We hurry onwards, the mess buckets clattering against the blocks of concrete. A shadow appears beside us.
"Are you the supply blokes from the first squadron?" comes the question out of the darkness. "Is that you, Domscheit?"
Winter demands in return.
"Yep. I've been waiting for you for 2 hours to show you the way."
Are we relieved? Domscheit is an Obergefreiter. He tells us that they carried out a counterattack this morning and are now positioned a bit further forward in the factory building. Winter swears.
"Every time we come, you are somewhere else. One day we'll probably deliver these supplies straight to Ivan." "Oh, that's been done before," says Domscheit.
"Last night, 4 men from the 74th Infantry Division walked right into Ivan's hands with food and ammunition. During the counterattack this morning, only empty containers were found. There was no sign of the men." We creep behind Domscheit, tracer whizzing in from both sides. I stumble and bang a metal strut with my canteen, making an awful row. Immediately a Russian machine gunner opens up and a strip of tracer bullets lights up the night. Ivan is pretty close. We lie down flat. The shots sing over my head and explode against the concrete block. The chalk